Hello, everyone. I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm going to be bringing you the Arizona Daily Star today for Tuesday, the 22nd of July, 2025. But I thought before we looked at the star, we'd go ahead and have a look at the weather this morning. So let's see what the National Weather Service has to say to us today in their synopsis. They say that there's a chance of showers and thunderstorms through today, then drying out for most of southeast Arizona into the coming weekend. High temperatures generally below normal through Wednesday, then heating up into the weekend. So, folks, that's the weather for the next few days. Let's go ahead and now turn to the Arizona Daily Star. And before we begin, I'd like to pause just to thank the Star very much for donating this subscription. We really appreciate it. Let's go ahead and look at the front page stories. As raids ramp up, residents stay inside. Families can get on child care wait list. They can. The third story is Trump issues MLK docs, and the fourth of four stories this morning, beef prices have soared and are likely to stay high. Let's go ahead and look at that first story. As raids ramp up, residents stay inside. And this is a story that occurs in Texas. These days, Juanita says a prayer every time she steps off the driveway of her modest rural home. The 41-year-old mother who crossed into the United States from Mexico more than two decades ago and married an American carpenter fears federal agents may be on the hunt for her. As she was about to leave for the pharmacy late last month, her husband called with a frantic warning, namely, immigrant enforcement officers were swarming the store's parking lot. Juanita, who is pre-diabetic, skipped filling medications that treat her nutrient deficiencies. She also couldn't risk being detained because she has to care for her 17-year-old daughter, who has Down syndrome. If I am caught, who is going to help my daughter? Juanita asks in Spanish through an interpreter. Some people quoted in this story insisted that the Associated Press publish only their first names because of concerns over their immigration status. As the Trump administration intensifies deportation activity around the country, some immigrants, including many who have lived in Texas's southern tip for decades, are unwilling to leave their homes, even for necessary medical care. Tucked behind the freeway strip malls, roadside taquerias, and vast citrus groves that span this 160-mile stretch of the Rio Grande Valley are people like Juanita who need critical medical care in one of the nation's poorest and unhealthiest regions. For generations, Mexican families have harmoniously settled, some legally, some not, in this predominantly Latino community where immigration status was once hardly top of mind. White House officials have directed federal agents to leave no location unchecked, including hospitals and churches, in their drive to remove 1 million immigrants by year's end. Those agents are even combing through the federal government's largest medical record databases to search for immigrants who may be in the United States illegally. Deportations and tougher restrictions will come with consequences, says Mark Krikorian, who's the director for the Center for Immigration Studies. It's a think tank that favors restrictive immigration policies. We shouldn't have let it get out of hand the way we did, Krikorian says, of the previous administration's immigration policies. Some businesses are going to have difficulties. Some communities are going to face difficulties. Federal agents' raids began reaching deeper into everyday life across the Rio Grande Valley in June, just as the area's 1.4 million residents began their summer ritual of enduring the suffocating heat. This working class stretch of Texas solidly backed Trump in the 2024 election, despite campaign promises to ruthlessly pursue mass deportations. People here, who once moved regularly from the U.S. to Mexico to visit relatives or get cheap dental care, say they didn't realize his deportation campaign would focus on their neighbors. But in recent weeks, restaurant workers have been escorted out mid-shift, and farmers have suddenly lost field workers. School children talk openly about friends who lost a parent in raids. More than a dozen were arrested last month at local flea markets, according to local news reports and Border Patrol officials. Immigrants are staying shut inside their mobile homes and shacks that make up the colonias, zoning-free neighborhoods that sometimes don't have access to running water or electricity, says Sandra De La Cruz Yerison, who runs the Holy Family Services Incorporated Clinic in Weslego, Texas. People are not going to risk it, De La Cruz Yerison says. People are being stripped from their families. Yet people here are among the most medically needy in the country. Nearly half of the population is obese. Women are more likely to be diagnosed with cervical cancer, and elderly people are more likely to develop dementia. Bladder cancers can be more aggressive. One out of every four people lives with diabetes. As much as a third of the population doesn't have health insurance to cover those ailments, and a quarter of people live in poverty, more than double the national average. Now, many in this region are on a path to develop worse health outcomes. They're on a path to develop worse health outcomes as they skip doctor appointments out of fear, says Dr. Stanley Fish, a pediatrician who helped open Driscoll Children's Hospital in the region last year. We've always had, unfortunately, people who have gone with untreated diabetes for a long time, and now it's compounded with these other issues at the moment, Fish says. This is a very dangerous situation for people. The population is suffering accordingly. So that's a little bit about the folks in Texas. And the title of that piece was, As Raids Ramp Up, Residents Stay Inside. Let's go to our next front page story. Families can get on child care wait list. Well, Arizona parents who are eligible to get subsidies for child care can once again get in line. The new state budget that just took effect allocates $125.9 million to this. However, that won't be anywhere near enough to cover the entire waiting list. Initial estimates are that this money, this $125.9 million, will provide help for 900 children and 530 families. But there are already about 6,100 children from nearly 3,700 families on the list. The system is set up so those who are at or below the federal poverty level, which is $26,650 a year for a family of three, are the first who will qualify, said Stacy Reinstein. And Stacy Reinstein is the Deputy Assistant Director of the Department of Economic Security. She said there are about 2,200 children on the list who fit that category. There is a chance there will be enough money to help even some who are not yet on the list, particularly if they fall in that poverty level category, Reinstein said Monday. They would have to wait their turn, but if they are among the most needy, they still would have a better chance of getting help than those who may have been on the list longer but have higher income. Governor Katie Hobbs has asked in January for $191 million, that's last January, for $191 million in state and federal funds for child care. But the budget ended up with the $125.9 million. Even with limited resources, however, this will be the first major dent in a waiting list that goes back years. Arizona didn't have a wait list until the administration of Governor Jan Brewer, who served from 2009 to 2015 as governor, when lawmakers cut state funding. The list shrank in 2018 when the state got a federal grant. Then, when COVID-19 hit, Arizona got $1.2 billion in federal COVID funds for child care. The state also finally updated its reimbursement rate for child care centers several years ago, the first time that has happened since 2000, said Barbie Prinster, who's executive director of the Arizona Early Childhood Education Association. That was no problem as long as federal dollars were coming in, but then the federal funds dried up. Last year, lawmakers provided $12 million in state funds, the first state dollars provided to the issue in a dozen years. However, that wasn't enough money to fund the system, Prinster said, not only because of the number of applicants, but also the higher reimbursement rate. So that's why the wait list had to start. It was created on August 1st, 2024. Eligibility starts with income. Strictly speaking, the program provides subsidized child care for any families making less than 165% of the federal poverty level, about $43,970 for a family of three. But the chances of anyone above the federal poverty level getting aid depend on how far those dollars stretch. Reinstein said the system set up by the DES, Department of Economic Security, will first use the funds it has to reach those at or below the federal poverty level. Only then, and only when and if there is money left, will DES start funding those with 110% of the federal poverty level. And as dollars remain available, families in subsequent higher income categories will get help up to the 165% limit. She said this phased release means that in the end, there could be more than 900 children who get care from the funds state lawmakers made available. There are, however, other variables. Some children get to skip the line entirely. They include those in families getting money from DES, such as recipients of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that's called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, who are employed, and those in a program who are searching for jobs. They are considered categorically eligible. The same is true for children who are referred from the Department of Child Safety. Except for those who automatically qualify, a parent has to work at least 20 hours a week. That means there is no help for those who want to go out and search for a job, Prinster said. The people that want to go to work are screwed, she said. Reinstein acknowledged that gap. If they don't meet the current DES child care eligibility requirements, we are limited with that, she said. I think there are multiple ways that people can seek assistance, whether it's through their child care provider or through their community to help support that. None of what DES provides is absolutely free to recipients. The federal government requires families to share in the cost of care through a co-payment, Reinstein said, with that link to family income. Even those at or below the federal poverty line are supposed to pay $1 per day for each child. Prinster, whose organization represents private licensed child care centers, said that that kind of copay is important for parents, having some skin in the game and having a little bit of responsibility. She said there's another factor, however, based on the rates providers charge, which can vary depending on the age of the child. She said, so let's say DES is reimbursing me $300 a week for an infant, but I, as a child care center, charge $350 for that week. Princeter said, the business can choose whether or not they want to charge that difference. 9 times out of 10, the parents, are not going to be able to afford it, she said, considering many parents probably make only the minimum wage, which in Arizona is $14.70 an hour. What's happening now is the state is sending letters and text messages out to those on the wait list who are the most needy. That provides a way to connect them with DES caseworkers. So that's a little bit about families can get on the child care wait list, but it is a long list with conditions. Let's go to our next story. Trump issues MLK docs. And the family objects to release, that's MLK's family, objects to the release of FBI records on civil rights leader. The Trump administration released records of the FBI's surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. despite opposition from the slain Nobel laureate's family and the civil rights group that he led until his 1968 assassination. The release involves more than 240,000 pages of records that were under a court-imposed seal since 1977, when the FBI first gathered the records and turned them over to the National Archives and Records Administration. King's family, including his two living children, that's Martin III, who is 67, and his daughter Bernice, who is 62, they were given advance notice of the release and had their own teams review the records ahead of the public disclosure. Those efforts continued, even as the government unveiled the digital trove. In a lengthy statement Monday, the King children called their father's assassination a, quote, captivating public curiosity for decades. But the pair, that's the pair of children, emphasized the personal nature of the matter and urged that, quote, these files must be viewed within their full historical context. It was not immediately clear Monday whether the release would shed any new light on King's life, the civil rights movement, or his murder. As the children of Dr. King and Mrs. Coretta Scott King, his tragic death has been an intensely personal grief, a devastating loss for his wife, children, and the granddaughter he never met. An absence of our family has endured for over 57 years, they all wrote. We ask those who engage with the release of these files to do so with empathy, restraint, and respect for our family's continuing grief. They also repeated the family's long-held contention that James Earl Ray, the man convicted of assassinating King, was not solely responsible, if at all. A statement from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, called the disclosure unprecedented and said many of the records were digitized for the first time to make it possible. President Donald Trump promised as a candidate to release files related to President John F. Kennedy's 1963 assassination. When Trump took office in January, he signed an executive order to declassify the JFK records, along with those associated with Robert F. Kennedy's and King's 1968 assassinations. Besides fulfilling the intent of his January executive order, the latest release serves as another alternative headline for Trump as he tries to mollify supporters angry over his administration's handling of records concerning the sex trafficking investigation of Jeffrey Epstein, who killed himself behind bars while awaiting trial in 2019 during Trump's first presidency. On Friday, Trump ordered the Justice Department to release grand jury testimony, but stopped short of unsealing the entire case file. So that is a little bit about Trump issuing and issues the MLK docs. Let's go ahead and move on to the last front page story this morning. It is, beef prices have soared and are likely to stay high. Anyone firing up the grill this summer already knows hamburger patties and steaks are expensive. But the latest numbers show prices have climbed to record highs. And experts say consumers shouldn't expect much relief soon. The average price of a pound of ground beef rose to $6.12 in June, up nearly 12% from a year ago, according to U.S. government data. The average price of an uncooked beef steak rose 8% to $11.49 per pound. But this is not a recent phenomenon. Beef prices have been steadily rising over the past 20 years because the supply of cattle remains tight while beef remains popular. In fact, the U.S. cattle herd has been steadily shrinking for decades. As of January 1, the U.S. had 86.7 million cattle and calves, down 8% from the most recent peak in 2019. That is the lowest number of cattle since 1951, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Many factors, including drought and cattle prices, have contributed to that decline. And now, the emergence of a pesky parasite in Mexico and the prospect of widespread tariffs may further reduce supply and raise prices. Here's a look at what's causing the price of beef to rise as follows. The fact that there's a smaller herd. The American beef industry has gotten better at breeding larger animals so ranchers can provide the same amount of beef with fewer cattle, said David Anderson, a livestock economist at Texas A&M. Then, in 2020, a three-year drought began that dried out pastures and raised the cost of feed for cattle, according to the American Farm Bureau. Drought has continued to be a problem across the West since then, and the price of feed has put more pressure on ranchers who already operate on slim profit margin. There's another. It's a disease dilemma. The emergence of a flesh-eating pest in cattle herds in Mexico has put extra pressure on supply because officials cut off all imports of cattle from south of the border last year. Some 4% of the cattle the U.S. feeds to slaughter for beef comes from Mexico. There's tariff trouble also that causes a decrease in the supply. President Donald Trump's tariffs have yet to have a major impact on beef prices, but they could be another factor that drives prices higher because the U.S. imports more than 4 billion pounds of beef every year. So prices are likely to stay high. It's the height of grilling season, and demand in the U.S. for beef remains strong, which Kansas State agricultural economist Glenn Tonsor said will help keep prices higher. If prices remain this high, shoppers will likely start to buy more hamburger meat and fewer steaks. But that doesn't appear to be happening broadly yet. And people also don't seem to be buying chicken or pork instead of beef. Nelson said that recently the drought has eased, allowing the pasture conditions to improve, and grain prices are down, thanks to the drop in export demand for corn because of the tariffs. Those factors, combined with the high cattle prices, might persuade more ranchers to keep their cows and breed them to expand the size of their herds. So we'll see. Beef prices have soared and are likely to stay high because of smaller herd, because of a disease, and because of tariffs. There you have it. Beef prices are soaring today. And now, having finished those front page stories, their titles were, "As Raids Ramp Up, Residents Stay Inside." "Families Can Get on Child Care Wait List." "Trump Issues MLK Docs." And the fourth of four on the front page this morning, "Beef Prices Have Soared and Are Likely to Stay High." Let's go ahead and move to the local news now in the Tucson and Region section of the Star. And if you've just joined us, welcome in. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm reading the Arizona Daily Star for today, the 22nd of July, 2025, and I'm now in the local news section. And the first story is, "New Office for Prison Oversight Can't Start Work." Well, what's this about? Well, it says the creation of an independent oversight office for Arizona prisons was signed into law, but it lacks the necessary funding to begin its work. Senate Bill 1507, that's 1507, was the latest in a series of bills introduced in the legislature over the past several years that pushed for an independent body to serve as a watchdog over the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. Bills introduced to the House and Senate in the past had failed, but this bill, sponsored by Senator Shauna Bolick, Republican from Phoenix, it stuck, but it's not been funded. It passed the legislature with bipartisan support and was signed by Governor Katie Hobbs on July 1st. SB 1507 establishes an office to monitor prison conditions and assess the corrections department's compliance with federal and state laws regarding the health, safety, welfare, and rehabilitation of incarcerated people. The office will also serve as an information hub for people in prison and their families, investigate complaints, and submit annual reports to elected leaders about Arizona's prisons. The corrections department was neutral on the bill, but had concerns that the independent office would duplicate their own work and transparency efforts and confuse the public about who to reach out to. A department representative told lawmakers earlier this year, "Criminal justice advocates and lawmakers celebrated the long-awaited creation of a new office, but were concerned and frustrated over the funding roadblock. It wasn't a fight this year to get the votes," said Kara Jansen, who was formerly incarcerated and helped push for the independent office over the years. Jansen is also the head of Dream.org's Empathy Network, a nonpartisan group that advocates for criminal justice reform across the nation. "It was more so a fight to get the budget," Jansen said. Bolick, the person who introduced SB 1507, accused Hobbs of refusing to allocate a single dollar to the new oversight body. Bolick said in a July 3 news release that Hobbs was creating the illusion of progress. "If she believes in this office, she needs to fund it," Bolick said. "I'm calling on her to identify immediate funding, whether from her own office or through reallocation from another agency within her cabinet. This is the least she can do to ensure her signature actually means something." So that's a little bit of information on new office for prison oversight can't start work because they don't have yet the funding to do so. The next story is that a UA researcher wants you to send her your ticks. Arizona researchers and health experts have been working to track a rare disease in the state, and they have a request. Quote, "Send us your ticks," unquote. In the summer of 2003, a 14-month-old boy was taken to a community health clinic with a rash and fever after new complications, a hospital transfer, and multiple days of treatment with anti-inflammatory drugs and antibiotics, he died on the sixth day from pulmonary hemorrhage without doctors knowing the culprit. Days later, they found in his blood serum the DNA remnants of a rare bacterium that is transmitted through tick bites. It was the first official case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in the state, the most severe tick-borne illness in the country. The disease was not unknown to scientists, but the vector was. Arizona became the first place where scientists confirmed that a common species of tick called the brown dog tick, that's the brown dog tick, could carry the bacteria. Ticks thrive in brushy or wooded areas with moderate temperatures and some humidity. In general, they are not abundant in deserts. Then, in 2014, a group of bird watchers in southern Arizona borderlands got tick bites and a weird fever. It was less severe, and it was a less severe bacterial illness, but it was carried by a different tick that was not expected to survive in Arizona's arid lands. There seems to be a pattern that we don't know about a tick-borne disease risk until somebody gets sick, said Kathleen Walker, a professor of entomology and an extension specialist at the University of Arizona. I thought, she said, wouldn't it be nicer if we could find diseases in the ticks before we find them in people? For the past 2 years, Walker has been leading the Great Arizona Tick Check, called the Great Arizona Tick Check, a collaborative project with the Arizona Department of Health to create a database that will map the distribution of different species of ticks in Arizona and the diseases they sometimes carry. For this effort, she is asking for help. If you find ticks on yourself, your home, your dog, or livestock, Walker said, take the tick off, put it in a baggie, and send it to me. The male ticks are genetically identified and tested for pathogens. So far, Walker's lab at the University of Arizona has received about 200 samples from across the state, identifying at least 6 species of ticks. Getting people involved serves a double purpose, specifically research and outreach. As an extension specialist, she wants to inform the public about potential problems in their community. Tick-borne diseases are common in parts of the country, but Southwesterners might be less familiar with them. It's rare in Arizona to encounter ticks, but when people do, they have no idea about the risks. It's a rare but fatal disease, is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It was first identified in Montana some 200 years ago, but today it is all over the country. The illness is caused by Rickettsia rickettsii. That's Rickettsia rickettsii bacteria and transmitted through tick bites. It's mostly transmitted by 3 different species of ticks in Arizona by the brown dog tick, which can be found all across the country and the state. Every single county in Arizona has a healthy population of brown dog ticks. So I think we should keep that in mind if we're out in brushy areas. UA researcher wants you to send her your ticks. And once again, that is Dr. Walker, an entomologist at the University of Arizona. Let's go ahead and move on to the next local story. Program trains clients to treat opioid overdoses. When Leroy Scott saw a man suffering from an opioid overdose and hyperventilating and rolling in the dirt, he knew he had to act fast. It was shocking to see someone in that state of mind. It was scary for me, said Scott, who is in the heat. He is actually the heat relief manager for Social Spin Foundation. It's called the Social Spin Foundation. It's a nonprofit that services Phoenix and Phoenix's homeless community. I had to save this man's life by any means necessary, so I got the Narcan and sprayed it in his nostril, and 2 to 3 minutes later, he was back. On a scorching hot afternoon at the Foundation's Phoenix facility, Scott shared his story with members of the unsheltered community during a training workshop that showed attendees how to administer naloxone. That's naloxone. And that's the scientific name for Narcan, naloxone. It's an antidote used to treat opioid overdoses. Naloxone, sold under the brand name Narcan, is often carried by first responders and caregivers, typically administered as a nasal spray. It takes about 2 to 3 minutes to take effect and can block the impact of opioids for 30 to 90 minutes. Social Spin, that's that foundation, which also provides free laundry to community members in need, has offered a variety of workshops every Wednesday to its clients for 2 years. Topics include nutrition, vaccine hesitancy, and how to apply for aid, in addition to harm reduction. It equips them to say with confidence that I, as an everyday person living my life in the world, can do something if I suspect that somebody is in trouble or having an overdose, said Samantha Kelvin, who's the Social Spin Director of Education and Social Impact. In addition to training community members about the benefits of using Narcan, Social Spin Foundation also offers incentives in the form of gift cards for people who attend its array of workshops. They educate us on different ways of getting help with the state or the city or the government as far as assistance, said David Dominguez, a client who lives in a car with his dog, a boxer named Ellie. We get gift cards from them at the end of the class, so we benefit off that. I use it for gas, and we use it for food. The workshops can also provide a sense of camaraderie, Calvin said. We've had people here who have attended every single workshop, never missing one for 2 years straight, which is pretty unheard of in the unsheltered community to have that long-term relationship with people, Calvin said. I've heard from others that they feel particularly welcomed here. So I think that's what keeps people coming back. So that's an organization, Social Spin Foundation, that helps with clients having opioid overdoses. Let's go ahead and move on now and talk about a little bit of politics, some local politics. Robson and Biggs file campaign funding reports. Karen Taylor Robson edged out Andy Biggs in money raised in the last quarter as they compete to be the Republican nominee for Arizona governor in 2026. But the donations tell only part of the story, as each hopes to be able to take on incumbent Democrat Katie Hobbs, who is seeking another 4-year term as governor. New reports filed Monday show Robson, who made an unsuccessful bid to become the GOP nominee in 2022, listing nearly $575,000 in individual donations and another $2,500 from political action committees. Biggs, a former state senator and now a member of Congress, had about $610,710 in donations. He also has $50,000 left over from a former campaign for the legislature. Robson, however, reports she loaned her campaign more than $2.2 million in the past quarter. She has been burning through that with an extensive media campaign, virtually all of it touting that Donald Trump said publicly last year that he would back her if she got into the race. Her campaign has spent $2.2 million in advertising, the report said. So, even with the self-borrowed money, Robson's cash on hand is now about $876,000. This isn't the first time Robson, who has never held elected office, has dug into her own pocket in her bid for election. She loaned herself $16.9 million in 2022 in her unsuccessful bid to be the GOP nominee, only to lose to Carrie Lake, who in turn lost the general election to Katie Hobbs. Biggs, off to a slower start, he didn't enter the race until January, spent only about $180,000 in the past 3 months, most of that on mailing services and consultants. That leaves him with about $437,000 in the bank. But Biggs has an edge on something that doesn't show up in his report. Spending on his behalf, and there's a lot of it, Turning Point Action, that's capital T, capital P, capital A, Turning Point Action, which supports what it says are conservative candidates, reported it already spent nearly $459,000 on behalf of Biggs. That includes $352,000 for TV ads. Much of the Political Action Committee's funds were funneled through 110, that's the numeral 1, and the number 10, T-E-N, LLC, owned by State Senator Jake Hoffman, a Queen Creek Republican who heads the Arizona Freedom Caucus. Hoffman describes his operation as a full-service agency handling everything from TV, radio, and cable TV ads to social media and mail. These independent expenditures are not limited by state law. There is only a requirement that they be listed and that the organizations behind them cannot coordinate with the candidate. Robson also is getting the benefit of outside spending. This from Building a Better Arizona, a political action committee that was formed specifically to help Robson get the nomination. It is being chaired by former State Senate President Karen Fan. So there you have it, folks. That's a little bit of political update on the Robson and Biggs campaigns against Katie Hobbs. So those are the local news stories that are on the Tucson and Region front page. New office for prison oversight can't start work because it doesn't have the funds. UA researcher wants you to send her your tics. Program trains clients to treat opioid overdoses. And the fourth of four local stories, Robson Biggs file campaign funding reports. Let's go ahead and move on to the business section of the Star this morning. And we can, I guess, first look at the market. And the markets are mixed. Looks like the Dow is off just a little. And the NASDAQ is up just a little. Both down and up less than 1%. So the market is mixed today. So let's go ahead and now look at the business stories. Microsoft works on patch after SharePoint hack. That's SharePoint has been hacked. Microsoft issued an emergency fix to close off a vulnerability in its widely used SharePoint software that hackers exploited to carry out widespread attacks on businesses and at least some U.S. government agencies. The company issued an alert to customers Saturday saying it was aware of the zero-day exploit being issued to conduct attacks that it was working to patch the problem. Microsoft updated its guidance Sunday with instructions to fix the problem for SharePoint Server 2019 and SharePoint Server Subscription Edition. Engineers were still working on a fix for the older SharePoint Server 2016 software. Anybody who's got a hosted SharePoint server has got a problem, said Adam Myers, Senior Vice President with CrowdStrike, a cybersecurity firm. It's a significant vulnerability. So what do you do now? That's the question. The vulnerability targets SharePoint server software. So customers of that product who want to immediately follow Microsoft's guidance to patch their own systems. They're going to want to do that. Although the scope of the attack is still being assessed, there's a warning that the impact could be widespread and recommended that servers impacted by the exploit, that's the zero exploit, be disconnected from the internet until they are patched. We are urging organizations, they say, says Microsoft, who are running on premium SharePoint, to take action immediately and apply all relevant patches now and as they become available. Rotate all cryptographic material and engage professional incident response. An immediate band-aid fix would be to unplug your Microsoft SharePoint from the internet until a patch is available. So there you have some information on Microsoft works on a patch after SharePoint, their SharePoint software has been hacked. Now, the second of two business stories this morning is more Americans are putting money into investments. New research finds that more Americans are shifting their money from checking and savings accounts into financial vehicles that pay an investment income, a trend that helps to explain the resilience of the U.S. economy after a bout of high inflation and recent uncertainty due to tariffs. The analysis by J.P. Morgan Chase Institute examined the accounts of 4.7 million households and found that people's total cash reserves are increasing when including new amounts going into brokerage accounts, money market funds, and certificates of deposit to assess people's well-being. Inflation-adjusted cash balances in checking and saving accounts remain low with a flat growth trajectory, but since the middle of 2024, total cash reserves have been increasing and approaching historical growth trends once the additional accounts are included, the analysis said. Families across many income bands are now seeing a turnaround in their total cash, said Chris Wheat, who's president of the Institute. Chris Wheat said it was hard to square the circle of consumer spending staying strong despite the lack of growth in checking and savings accounts, an issue that can now be explained by the people in a higher interest rate environment shifting more money into accounts that yield investment returns. He said people appear to be using the other accounts to manage their cash rather than simply making long-term investments. So, very interesting. More Americans are putting money into investments. So those are our business stories. Microsoft works on a patch after SharePoint software attack, and more Americans are putting money into investment accounts. Let's go ahead and move on to the opinion section of the Star this morning with the reminder to our listeners that the opinions that I'm about to read, and it looks like there are three of them this morning, are of the writers of those opinions. So the first one is more work required on Project Blue. And this opinion piece is brought to us this morning by Roque Perez. That's Roque Perez, R-O-C-Q-U-E, Roque Perez. He serves as the council member for Ward 5 in the city of Tucson. He is the youngest municipal official in Arizona and is committed. He's a committed advocate, he says, for public education, civic participation, and economic equity. Let's see what he has to say. More work required on Project Blue. Since my appointment to the city council, the Tucson City Council, I've committed to making decisions with immense care. That doesn't change just because a project is big, complicated, or controversial. And Project Blue is all three. In recent weeks, the City of Tucson and Pima County have released detailed information about Project Blue. Now, what is Project Blue? Project Blue is a proposal to turn nearly 300 acres of county-owned desert near the county fairgrounds into a massive data center. The county has already approved the land sale and zoning changes. Now the city is being asked to bring the property into Tucson's boundaries and approve a development agreement outlining expectations for jobs, infrastructure, water use, and environmental safeguards. The project would be led by Beale Infrastructure, that's B-E-A-L-E, Beale Infrastructure, a company with no finished projects to date. Tucson's data center would be one of its first. Beale is backed by Blue Owl Capital, an investment firm focused on digital infrastructure. We're told this project could bring about $3.6 billion in construction spending and create at least 180 full-time jobs with average pay of $64,000 a year. It would use treated recycled water rather than drinking water for its cooling needs and would build systems to return more water to the local groundwater supply than it uses. That's known as being water positive, quote unquote. The developer has agreed to pay for all electricity upgrades needed for the site rather than shifting those costs onto us. To date, no private project in Tucson's history has made this level of investment in recycled water infrastructure. Building 18 miles of pipeline, 9 water recovery wells, that's 9 water recovery wells, a new booster pump, and a 30-acre recharge site, all of which would be turned over to the city. It could also support efforts to address PFAS, industrial chemicals found in parts of our water system since isolating water systems. While this wouldn't be Tucson's first data center, it would be the largest, unlike many large developments that ask for tax breaks or exemptions. This one doesn't. Instead, it would begin generating property taxes to the benefit of Vail Unified School District, city, county, and the state, helping support public education, libraries, roads, transportation, housing, public health, and other services. But for a project of this significance, questions remain. Who will operate the facility? Beale is building it, but won't run it. It could be leased to any major tech company, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, or Meta. These companies have very different records when it comes to workers' rights, privacy, and environmental impact. We don't yet know who the end user will be. What kind of computing will take place? At first, many people feared this would be an AI, or artificial intelligence, facility, known for using immense power and water. Recent statements suggest use for cloud services are more probable, which are less resource-intensive and support everyday digital tools. But that's not confirmed, and the difference matters. As the youngest municipal office and official in Arizona, and one of the youngest in Tucson's history, I also think about the long term, not just next year, but what Tucson will look like in 10, 20, or 50 years. My generation will live with the consequences of climate change, shrinking resources, and growing corporate influence. That's why I'm not offering a yes or a no vote yet. I'm saying there's work to do before I'm ready to decide. That opinion piece by Roque Perez. He serves as the council member for Ward 5. Let's move on to our next opinion piece this morning. Here we go. It is an opinion piece entitled Anti-Semitism Act Veto by Hobbs Was Misguided. And this opinion piece is by Kent Blumenthal. He's the chair of the Stand With Israel Committee. Governor Hobbs was wrong last month to veto Arizona HB 2867, the Anti-Semitism in Education Act. The veto was a serious mistake that gives a green light to those already espousing anti-Semitic rhetoric and imitation within, that's intimidation, within Arizona's public schools. While rather than attacking our teachers, as Hobbes suggested, HB 2867 would have made those practicing anti-Semitism and intimidation of Jews accountable. The recent resolution against the Anti-Defamation League, adopted by the nation's largest teachers union, the National Education Association, is further proof that Hobbes' veto was misguided. Governor Hobbes, it is time to reaffirm that Arizona stands for diversity, safety, and dignity for all people, Jewish or not. Anti-Semitism, no matter the form it takes, must be confronted head-on, whether it occurs in our schools, on social media, or in public discourse. Freedom of speech is a cherished right, but so is the right to be free from fear and bigotry. And that opinion piece by Kent Blumenthal. He is the chair of the Stand with Israel Committee. Let's move on to our last opinion piece this morning. And there's a reminder that this is an opinion piece of the writer only. So, I support Shaw because she will listen, is the title of the opinion piece. And it is by Jane Evans. Jane Evans is a Tucson native, Ward 3 plant nursery business owner, and resident of Ward 3 for 57 years. Now more than ever, the vote we cast matters. It takes time to find out about candidates. We've become accustomed to looking at the Democrat or Republican, Independent or Green Party by the name and just checking the box or filling the circle. We can see daily the damage done by not finding out what candidates really believe. If you believe there are better solutions dealing with homelessness in Tucson, find out how the candidates feel. We have seen the homeless situation under Councilman Dahl. His record speaks for itself. Ward 3 suffers daily. Find out how the candidates feel about safety in Tucson. What are their ideas? Find out how the candidates would vote on the proposed Project Blue. This is a project that will ultimately affect all of us. Why, when Tucson collects its 8.7% in sales tax, are we in such financial trouble? Please spend the time it takes to learn about the candidates on your ballot. I have and I strongly support Sadie Shaw for Ward 3, but don't take my word for it. Read about her accomplishments on the TSD governing board. Take the time to make an informed decision. And there you have it, folks. Sorry for my voice, but that's the end of an hour on the Daily Star. And I'm Steve, a volunteer reader, wishing you the best of goodbyes.